Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we take you to the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations for a talk from economist Nader Habibi about the economic and political factors contributing to today's unrest in Iran. In this address, which was recorded before a live audience on January 12th, Habibi offers an analysis of the effects of decades of sanctions and explains how Iran's relationships to countries like China and Israel, as well as the emergence of a strong opposition to the Iranian government, could influence where Iran's people and leadership go next. We begin now with an introduction from Mid-Coast Forum President George Look.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the 490th meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations. Since its founding in 1983, the forum has met monthly to hear from an invited speaker on a topic central to U.S. foreign policy. At today's meeting, we are pleased to have Dr. Nader Habibi to speak on the economy of Iran in the shadow of international sanctions and the Supreme Leader. Dr. Habibi is the Henry J. Lehr Professor of Practice in the Economics of the Middle East at Brandeis University's Crown Center for Mideast Studies. I'd like to hear you say that three times quickly. He served as the Director of Islamic and Middle East Studies at Brandeis from August 2014 to August 2019. Before joining Brandeis in June of 2007, Dr. Habibi served as Managing Director of Economic Forecasting and Risk Analysis for Middle East and North Africa at the Global Insights Limited. He has worked in academic and research institutions in Iran, Turkey, and the United States since 1987. His most recent research projects are the economic impact of sanctions on Iran's middle class, the economic relations of Middle East countries with China, analysis of the excess supply of college graduates in Mideastern countries, interesting question, and economic relations of Turkey with Iran and the Arab countries. He earned a master's degree in systems engineering and his PhD in economics from Michigan State University. Nader, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
So first of all, thank you, George, for inviting me. Thank you, your organizing team. And thank you, all of you, for being here today. These days, Iran is in the news. And what we see in TV, there are images of people chanting in the streets against the Korean regime. But this is not the first episode. Actually, if we go back to 47 years ago, 1979, January 1979, that year also people were in the streets of, in the streets of Tehran. Back then, people were chanting, long live Ayatollah Khomeini, death to Shah. Those protests were successful, and they resulted in the Islamic Revolution. If the current regime survives for another 4 weeks, on February 10th, it will celebrate the 47th anniversary of the Islamic regime. But from those protests in favor of Khomeini, we have now moved to a new chant, new slogan in protest. People are chanting, long live King Pahlavi, and they are chanting his name. So you can see how the situation has changed in these 47 years. What has happened in these 47 years really is the legacy of two leaders of Iran. The first one, the founder of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, who ruled for almost 10 years. And after that, in 1989, the new leader of Iran was elected, Ayatollah Khamenei, who is still the leader of Iran after 37 years. And very much when we think about what has happened to Iran's foreign policy, what has happened in Iran domestically in terms of economic and political conditions, one could say that these are the legacies of Ayatollah Khamenei. He's now 86 years old, and the political system that he and the Islamic clerics around him have established in Iran, one could call it an illiberal electoral republic. In Iran, like many countries, you have a division of power, you have an independent judiciary, a parliament that is elected, and often you see people asserting their opinions. There are even occasionally fist fights in the parliament, similar to Taiwan or Turkey, and an executive branch in which the president is also elected. But all of those branches are under the authority of one man, an institution called the Supreme Leader, which is the Ayatollah Khamenei. He has absolute veto power on all government decisions, and he is the commander in chief of all Iranian armed forces, and there are many of them in Iran. Therefore, the direction of foreign policy and all key decisions in the country are under his supervision and his command. That's why I said that what we see here is really very much what we see as Iran today is, to a large extent, his legacy. And he is a very ideological individual. So when we look at, for example, Iran's foreign policy, there are some key aspects that stand out. One of them is this commitment to anti-Americanism and anti-imperialism, which has meant that there has been tension between Iran and the United States for all of these 47 years. In association with that, Iran has been committed to supporting the Palestinians, opposing Israel, even though Iranian government does not say we would like to destroy Israel, contrary to what people say. It always says we need to have an election in Israel in which all people, including Palestinians, decide the fate. But it has been interpreted, his postures, the postures of Ayatollah Khamenei and Iran have been interpreted as being anti-Israel very much, and they have provoked a very strong response from Israel over the past four decades. Another dimension of his foreign policy is support for Shiism and the Shiite minorities of Islamic religion throughout the Middle East, in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Saudi Arabia. And that support for Shiites has led to tension with the Arab world. Soon after the revolution, it resulted in the Iran-Iraq war, which lasted for almost 10 years. Another dimension is the close relation with Russia and China, partly as a defensive mechanism, given that he is committed to fighting against the West and Israel in search of allies. Khamenei has brought Iran very close to the orbit of Russia and China. So given this very confrontational foreign policy, which to a large extent is rooted in his ideology and the core supporters of this Ayatollah within the regime, he has paid a very high priority to strengthening Iran's defense. Significant expenditure on weapons developments. Since Iran has been subject of sanctions, it has not been able to purchase weapons from outside. Therefore, he has been committed to developing Iran's missile industry and missile capabilities. Parallel to that, Iran has been committed to developing its nuclear program. It claims that the program is for peaceful intentions, but several indications point to the fact that the military applications of nuclear programs is very much in the mind of the political elite in Iran. In terms of domestic policies, his government has been committed to imposing the Islamic lifestyle on the entire society, which has resulted in a backlash. This backlash manifested itself during the Woman Life Freedom uprisings of 4 years ago. After that, his ability to impose the veil on women has diminished significantly. And if you look at the images of women in protests that are going on today, you see many women who are not wearing the veil or the headscarf. In terms of economic policy, Iran has a very strong public sector. The military is very actively involved in economic activities. As sanctions have forced some industries and factories into bankruptcy, the government, the Revolutionary Guards have stepped forward to acquire these industrial units with the justification that if we do not purchase them and manage them, we would have mass unemployment. And the result is that the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, own a significant amount of economic assets. And more recently, the government has given them the right to directly sell a portion of Iran's oil exports. So that portion does not come into the official budget of the country. The IRGC can directly sell that to use it for defense expenditures. The economy is known as a rentier oil exporting country. Parallel with those ownerships, the government initiated a privatization initiative about 20 years ago. But that privatization transferred public assets to friends and close allies of the regime. There was a lot of corruption, which is one of the causes of the anger that we observe in the society today. Protests are over many things, but one of them is about this perception of corruption and economic injustice. The economy is divided into almost two groups, the inner circle of the government and people who are affiliated with the political elite, and the rest of the society. Even for admission to universities or employment in public sector, there is a merit evaluation, but even before that, there is an evaluation based on political loyalty and whether you manifest an Islamic lifestyle, which is an example of how the economy is divided and economic opportunities. Now, this is important because oil, which is the most important resource, is exported by government, so oil revenues are in government hands. And because of the ability to distribute that oil revenue, government has significant amount of power over the economy. Another feature of Iranian economy is that while the government oppresses political rights, oppresses social rights and lifestyle, partly in order to compensate that, it offers one or two goods which are distributed by government at a very low price. So in this economy, oil products, especially gasoline, is sold at a very heavily subsidized price, so that 1 gallon of gasoline is almost sold for maybe 10 to 15 cents, depending on the exchange rate. So that has affected the economy significantly. On one hand, it results in budget deficits because government could have used that revenue if they were going to sell the oil at a rational price to cover other expenses. But they can't do that. They insist on providing that oil at a very cheap price for domestic consumption. It has also resulted in large amount of smuggling. to other countries, especially in the borders. So it is very inefficient. And the large fiscal deficit that government faces because of all of its obligations and the way it manages the budget results in having to print significant amount of money. And that results in inflation and the devaluation of national currency. Iran, on average, experiences between 20 to 30% inflation. In recent months, that even got worse. And ever since August, inflation has increased to about 40 to 50% per year on an annual basis. And imagine what that does to the purchasing of power of the people. That explains partly the anger that we see in the streets today. So the economy, really, when we want to understand it, we could say that Iran is engaged in what we can call an economic warfare, in which the most important weapon is economic sanctions. Iran has been a target of a variety of economic sanctions ever since the establishment of the Republic, Islamic Republic. Not only its oil exports are interrupted, the government cannot import freely what is needed, even for some of the basic commodities. And even more important, Iran is a target of financial sanctions, has been a target of that for several years, which means that banking transactions have been disrupted, partly sometimes at a very high rate. So on occasions when the country is able to export oil in other countries, it has difficulty transferring the oil revenues back into the country. One good example is relations with China. Chinese are the main economic partner of Iran, and they buy a large amount of oil. Right now, they are primary buyer of Iranian oil. But Iran cannot transfer the dollars easily. In return, it has to buy some goods from China because Chinese banks are not willing to violate the international sanctions and U.S. sanctions. After all, the most important global partner for China is the United States. And economic relations with the United States, even today, despite all the tensions, are far more important than relations with Iran. Two other aspects of this economic warfare. One of them is sabotage. Because of tensions with Israel, and since Israel has been able to develop some good and capable covert operations inside Iran, we often see occasionally sabotage in some of Iran's economic industrial units, especially cyber warfare, where, for example, in one day, all of the gas stations in Iran were not able to operate. And people were not able to purchase gasoline. Or sometimes the banking system faces disruption. So this has been going on, and all of this has resulted in significant weakening of the Iranian economy. So the result of that has been what we are experiencing today. Iran and Israel had a 12-day war, which caused significant damage to Iran's military leadership. It was a massive shock. After that, people thought that perhaps because of the large blow that war dealt to the Iranian regime, we might see some kind of change in the direction of regime. Perhaps a willingness to compromise, to change the direction from this confrontation with the US and Israel. But that did not happen. What happened was that the economic conditions worsened, the situation with respect to inflation and the exchange rate got even worse, especially in the 2 weeks before the start of current uprisings. The uprisings began on December 26th. In the few days before that, the exchange rate devalued very sharply. It was almost unprecedented. And the result was that even in Bazaar, which is a very conservative faction of Iranian society, which traditionally has always sided with the ruling Islamic regime, even they were frightened by the situation that emerged. So we had this protest in the Bazaar suddenly on 26th, which was purely for economic demands, demanding stability in the currency and some kind of stability in policies. But very soon, that expanded into political demands and mass protests, which moved well beyond economic demands. The protests changed direction towards a demand for regime change, especially with the calls for Pahlavi and chanting the name of Reza Pahlavi. This is where we stand today. Partly people realized after the 12-day war that the situation is hopeless. Iran is not willing to compromise. There might be another conflict with Israel because Iran has focused on enhancing its missile capability. I think that was the sense of despair that finally morphed into a sense of anger and brought people to the street, and we see that this chanting and protests have continued. And unfortunately, even though the first 10 days there wasn't much violence and it was just peaceful protests, past five days, it has become very violent. Now there are mentions of casualties of around 500. The regime has not compromised. There are some voices within the regime. There are some moderate factions, moderate groups, that have always been occasionally vocal, but they are not effective against Ayatollah Khamenei. Faced with these massive protests, the armed groups, the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, have announced that they are committed to protecting the regime. They call the protesters as people who are inspired by Israel and the United States. They deny that these have domestic legitimate grievances for these protests. But parallel to that, we see that there is a group within the government, within the regime, led by the former Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif and former President Hassan Rouhani, who are sort of trying to call for a moderation and a change in direction. And they have created a new party called the Iran Pact Party for a new pact, for a new agreement. It's not clear how successful there might be. The forces, military forces, have remained loyal to the regime so far, and they have shown resilience. We have to acknowledge that. But a new factor is this chanting around Reza Pahlavi, because Iran has had many episodes of uprisings. In the past, no single opposition leader has attracted attention. But for the first time, the name of Reza Pahlavi is being mentioned repeatedly and almost in all chants. These protests have now spread to all cities in Iran, and even small, large, everywhere. So they are unprecedented, and this emergence of a single leader is also unprecedented, which means that perhaps this time the protest might have a different outcome. So this brings me to the question of what are the scenarios ahead? What can happen given this situation? Another important factor to keep in mind is that the posture of United States towards these protests have been different from previous uprisings. In the past, when they happened during Obama administration or Biden administration, the US government tried to sort of remain passive and only offer mild support. And the reason was that they were afraid that if they express very vocal support, the government would use that as an excuse to suppress the protests. This time, President Trump, Donald Trump, has been different. He has issued an active warning. And that warning seems to have been taken seriously by all factions inside Iran, because it came the day after he extracted Maduro from Venezuela, which was, of course, a big surprise. And by the way, Venezuela has been a strong strategic and economic partner for Iran, and Iran had significant investments in Venezuela, which are now lost. Anyways, the support that President Trump expressed, I think, played an important role in motivating large number of people to come to the streets in Iran. So moving forward, I think both people and the ruling regime are really looking at what President Trump might do. So, and that will really have an impact on the outcome. What are some of the outcomes that can happen, given where we stand today? Well, one of the outcomes, perhaps, is that these protests might succeed. We don't know how, but we can't rule this out. If these protests succeed, Iran might move towards stability. There is a chance for that. But there is a risk that after they are successful, at least to remove the regime, some remnants of the regime might continue to fight back. There might be different other fractures, for example, ethnic fractures or ideological fractures, which might lead to a period of instability. So these are two factors to keep in mind if this protest succeeds. But we cannot rule out an alternative scenario that despite all of these protests and despite all of this international support that we are witnessing for these protests, including the President of the United States, the regime might be able to use brute force and suppress these protests. If that happens, the hostility towards the regime and the pressure on Iranian economy is likely to continue. And we will continue these cycles of oppression followed by another protest. So there might be another protest a year from now or 2 years from now, because people are not going to give up. Just as after the previous protests, people did not give up, and we see that they rose again. The third possibility is an internal change in the regime, given the pressure that it faces, and given that those pragmatic elements, such as the former foreign minister Javad Zarif, are still active within the regime, they might find a face-saving way of internal transformation, which might be similar to perhaps what happened in China after the death of Mao. This is more likely to happen if the regime survives and the current leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, dies, because after that, the chance of internal change would be much larger. So how these scenarios would emerge and which one of them has a higher chance, I think has a lot to do with the role of external players. The most important external player is President Donald Trump, and I already explained his position that he might interfere. Of course, it's a very complicated issue because Iran has used hypersonic missiles effectively. It has the capacity to perhaps retaliate if it faces any kind of military strike. And I think President Trump and his team are taking these potential outcomes well into account. But aside from the United States, we have to keep in mind that there are two other players that we cannot ignore, China and Russia. Because over the past 47 years, Iran has developed strong relations with both China and Russia. China is Iran's main economic partner, but Russia is its main strategic and military partner. During the Ukraine war, Iran has provided Russia with critical military hardware that Russia has effectively used in Ukraine, including the Shahed drones that are sort of like suicide drones that Russia uses in large number, very inexpensive and relatively effective so far. But even aside from that, Russia is looking at Iran as an important transit route because of the sanctions that Europeans have imposed and the difficulties that it faces for trade through the Baltic Sea and the Atlantic. Yeah, Russia and Iran have been developing what is known as the North-South Transportation Corridor, which would provide Russia access to the Persian Gulf, the Indian Ocean, through Iran. And Russia is helping Iran develop the hardware, the railway, the infrastructure, so that this North-South transportation corridor can be used by Russia in case of blockage in other routes that it uses for trade. Therefore, both the Russian government and the Chinese government have very high stakes in the outcome of these protests and the survival of the regime. China would be reluctant to engage in any kind of military intervention, and they have never done that in the past, but they might offer some kind of diplomatic support or perhaps covert support for the regime. We don't know, but I have talked to my former students in China, and based on what is being published, Chinese foreign affairs officials are very much commenting on the strategic value of Iran and how significant it is for them. So these external factors would also be important. In the meantime, the protests in Iran continue in different forms. One of the symbols of the protest today, and the images show that there are really very large numbers of people coming to the streets, is a symbol of a young woman who is using the picture of Ayatollah Khomeini to light a cigarette. This picture has gone viral all over the world. People are posting their own pictures, and some of them are very creative, showing women using the picture of Ayatollah Khomeini to light their cigarettes. Of course, I do not condone cigarette smoking. It is bad, and I hope people don't do it, but these pictures of this like this have gone viral. I think I'll stop here, and I hope things go well for the Iranian people. I have relatives there, and we all look for better times in the future and a good outcome of these protests. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I wish you had a better crystal ball that you could really predict the future for us, but I think the situation as you describe it is pretty fluid right now. You talked about the, while they're collecting questions here, I always take the opportunity to ask one of my own to begin with. You talked about an opposition leader who they might be able to rally around. And I believe that was the son of a Shah that was deposed in 1979. Could the people really rally around him? And would that lead to the reestablishment of the Shah, another authoritarian regime?
He has some supporters, but not everyone. There are those who prefer a republic. And majority of Iranians are really worried about any form of dictatorship after what they have experienced. I think Iranians have come to realize that he could be a good leader for this transition stage. But that doesn't mean that they support, all of them support a return to the monarchy. And he himself has been active for more than 40 years and repeatedly has said that he advocates for democracy, he advocates for a referendum which determines what type of government Iran would have in the future. So his position as the leader of transition, which is now really issuing directives every day for people what to do, where to go in the protests, is that a leader of this crucial and difficult transition. And it doesn't mean that it's a transfer to a new era of Pahlavi kingdom, in my opinion. That really depends on what happens after a potential regime collapse, if it ever happens.
There's several questions I see already related to the sanctions questions. Yes. One is, why does it appear that the sanctions have been so much more effective on Iran than they've been on Russia? Is it just the length of time they've been in place?
It is the length of time, and it's also, I think, because the United States, as the really the center of financial world, has the capacity to impose financial sanctions. It also has been able to impose effective oil sanctions. Now, why have they not been as effective in Russia? That began later, in my opinion. And remember, the sanctions have not by themselves resulted in government accepting the demands of the Western world. It's the severity of the sanctions that have resulted in such difficult conditions that people have risen. That has not been the case in Russia because their economy has been more resilient given the size of the economy and the fact that China has decided to partner with them, India has partnered with them. They have been able to sell their soul, their oil, not their soul, more effectively than Iran.
Let me stick with sanctions for a minute. Someone asks, how do Iranian weapon makers get access to the materials they need given the sanctions? Is there a lot of leakage of the sanctions?
Because these sanctions are old, they're more than four decades, Iranian government has developed countermeasures. And one of the reasons IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard, is involved in the economy because they have been active in finding ways for bypassing the sanctions, both for imports and exports. There is a network of front companies in many countries around the world, in Dubai, in Turkey, in Malaysia. Those front companies help Iran acquire whatever material and machinery it needs and also arrange for export of oil and non-oil goods. When, of course, this is a dynamic warfare. The United States discovers these front companies in one country. The government of that country shuts them down. They open up in another country. And this is a game that continues.
Let me move on a little bit here. Someone wants to know, does the regime have the security forces large enough to put down the current demonstrators? Or is it, if the demonstrators get large enough, is that going to be overwhelm the capability?
It is powerful enough if they decide to just use force. They do have that, but they have to think about the consequences. And I think that is the deterrence because then there would be international backlash. But at the moment, they have the resources to confront because people are not armed. And just recently, today and yesterday, they have been able to prevent gatherings by directly shooting at people. to injure them and to kill them. So they can if they decide to do so, unfortunately.
Then how about the Iranian view of the United States, the Iranians' view of the United States? With their past mistrust of the U.S. and the CIA, how is the potential U.S. involvement being viewed by the protest movement and the people? Do they welcome the U.S.?
Right. I think because majority of people blame the government itself for what has happened, its foreign policy and its domestic economic policy, the opinion about the United States has shifted, and this is verified by various polls, independent polls of opinions. And from what you hear in social media, where people are free to express their opinion, the attitude towards the United States is not as negative as it was 47 years ago. And among some, I would say, middle class in the society, it is quite positive. And because they blame the government for the tensions. Surprisingly, even in the Middle East, the attitude towards Israel is not as negative as the Arab countries. And the sympathy for Palestinians in Iran, again, surveys have shown that is far lower than other Arab countries. And I think this is also a reaction because people believe that the support that government has offered to Palestinians has resulted in the conflict with Israel, which has resulted in all the sanctions and suffering. So by association, they refuse to blame Israel and they prefer to focus on pressuring the government to change its course.
And would you comment a little bit more on Iran's neighbors, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, et cetera, and how they think about the possibility of the overturn of the current government?
I don't think they expect a significant change. Iran has had tensions with Arab countries, with Saudi Arabia in particular. There have been proxy wars between the two countries in Iraq, in Lebanon. They each support a faction, and those factions have gone to war. In Yemen, for example, the Houthis. So the relations were not good. But in 2023, with the mediation of China, Iran and Saudi Arabia have normalized. So now the hostilities have diminished. And there has been more cooperation and less tension between the two governments. The governments, I think, they're just waiting and watching to see what will happen as a result of the current, protests. And I think they are cautious about change because there is some concern that the shift in foreign policy would be so strong that the United States might shift towards friendship with Israel, which affects their policy vis-a-vis Israel. And there is also concern that Iran might become an ally of the United States, and these Gulf oil-exporting countries might not have this important privileged position as the only allies of the United States. So these are all concerns that I think they are thinking about these days.
Then, in particular, how about Iran's relationship with Iraq? How do they influence? How much influence do they have over them? You haven't spoken a lot about the Iranian support of Hamas or Hezbollah, right, or whatever. I mean, how does that play into the dynamics of the region?
So, support for militia groups in various countries, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, all of that was part of Iran's broad regional strategy. The argument was that if we have these groups at the front near Israel, then they would support they would be part of our defense, regional defense, And they would prevent Israel or United States from attacking us because we can use those to retaliate. But all of that changed in the past 2 years after the October 7 war. Hezbollah is no longer effective. Syria has had a regime change, and that has significantly diminished Iran's ability to exert influence in the region. In Iraq, there are still militia groups, Shia militia groups, that have close relations with Iran. But the Iraqi government, which is itself a Shia government, tries to remain neutral, and it has sort of developed good relations with other Arab countries, with Saudi Arabia, and with Iran. And right now, under US pressure, that government is trying to reduce the influence of the militias that are affiliated with Iran. And they have been quiet in recent weeks. I think Iran's influence through those militias is much less than before, and it's hard for it to restore them. Influence on Iraqi government through those militias was significant over the years, but in 2025, it is not as strong.
There's a question on whether you think there's any indication of organized external efforts by unrest that's actually starting, it's happening in Iran. Is it being organized externally, or is it really an internal uprising?
I think the primary factor is just this frustration with the regime. It is domestic grievances, lack of freedom, and economic hardship. The propaganda, the efforts from outside to instigate uprisings have been happening all the time, continuously, by various organizations around the world. But the fact that uprisings take place now represents the new developments in the past few months that I mentioned, the economic pressure that is unprecedented. So I think it's very much domestic. And then when you look at the numbers, when you look at the pictures, the large number of masses are beyond the amount that you can inspire by external motivation or external resources. It is really something domestic, in my opinion.
You've talked a lot about the economic situation and how that's motivating the current unrest. How high is the unemployment, especially among the young? What percentage have college degrees? Do they have job opportunities? Could you address a little bit about the actual plight of the average Iranian in the current situation?
Of course. When you are very poor, you can't afford to be unemployed. I'm sure many of you have heard this. So for people with technical degrees, with engineering, with managerial skills, unemployment rate is high, but they all try to find something else to do which has nothing to do with their skills. For example, many people drive what we have as equivalent to Uber. Uber is called a Snap. So they just drive cars as rideshare or services similar to that. What matters is poverty, because those who work, their salaries are not sufficient. I think the now, given the current exchange rate, the income of an average minimum wage worker could be equivalent to $100 per month, which is very hard to use that to cover any of your expenses. So what is felt as economic difficulty is widespread poverty. Good jobs are rare, but people have to find something to do. So a lot of low-paying, inefficient, lower-skilled jobs are just created, or people try to sell something in order to make some money. But the real functioning and productive economy is very much weak, very weak these days.
And how about the health of the black market for goods in Iran. Given the high inflation rate, there must be a black market.
Yes.
There. Is it mainly the elites who benefit from the black market? I mean, is it throughout the society?
Well, what happens is that government provides hard currency at subsidized rate to some corporations to import food or medicine. And some of that is embezzled, and some of the goods that they bring into the country, they sell in black market for much higher price. So these days, what we see is a shortage of food, which is really resulting in food insecurity, and shortage of all kinds of medicine, which at official low price are not available, but you can buy them in black market. At high level, at the very top of the distribution chain, all of these imports are facilitated by corporations that are affiliated with the regime. And that's why when these days the corruption cases are exposed, often the people involved are part of the political elite who have been involved. But at the lower level of this distribution chain, everyone is involved. Part of the way that ordinary people try to make a little bit of money is to operate in that black market for any kind of good that people need.
Then let me just switch gears again on this. And you talked a little bit about the hypersonic missiles. So there were several questions.
Yes.
One person said, we've heard a lot about the nuclear situation, but very little about hypersonic missiles. Could you speak more about it? In particular, do they have them? Who did they build them themselves or get them from externally? And have they been tested and used?
The short answer is, I'm not an expert on that field and I don't know. But based on what I have gathered just as a non-expert, Iran has a domestic weapons industry, military defense technology, and there are some well-educated individuals who for ideological reasons, believe in the ideology of the regime, are operating as scientists, as engineers to develop these weapons. And they are receiving some technical assistance from Russia. They also buy technical assistance in the black market. There are experts around the world that if you pay them a good amount of money, they are willing to cooperate and transfer knowledge. But production is taking place. They have been used, and we have seen them used against certain separatist Kurdish groups in Iraq, and also a few of them were used against Israel, that even Israeli government acknowledged. That is an aspect of Iran's defense activity that has been accelerated after the 12-day war, because that's practically the only thing they have as deterrence.
And then you talked about the connection between Iran and Russia and Iran and China. And you talked about how Russia has some real benefits from. Yes. But someone wants to know, for China, Iran needs China, but does China really need Russia? Is it possible China would be better off with a change in the regime in Iran?
Oh, you mean
Iran? If there were change in regime, okay. Could China be better off than they are now?
Sure. One of the constant features of Chinese foreign policy up until now is that they focus on economic relations, and even if there is a regime change in a country, they continue to work with that country and maintain good relations. A good example of that is Egypt. China was a strong economic partner for Hosni Mubarak before 2010. There was a transition, and now China is still the strong partner, the main economic partner with large amounts of investments in Egypt. We see the same thing in Iraq. China was active during Saddam Hussein. It is still active because it believes in non-interference. And countries around the world observe that it doesn't interfere in their domestic policies. They consider China a good economic partner, but not a strategic ally. And this is the lesson that Iran learned over time. The Iranian government was always under the assumption that if they provide oil to China, they become so important that China is willing to offer them substantial support. But that's not the case. Yet still, China is Iran's major partner. So I think they're going to maintain that posture of neutrality unless the United States provokes them so much that they have no alternative. Keep in mind, Venezuela was an important supplier of oil to China. Greenland is a region that China has been trying to invest because of its massive resources. President Trump has made these important changes in Venezuela. We don't know what might happen in Greenland, but from the Chinese point of view, the United States is trying to disrupt their supply chain for raw materials and particularly oil. And so whether they would have a change of posture in the future will be seen. But so far, they try to work with all countries and all.
And let me end by asking what you would say is a good outcome for Iran and what might we be able to hope for? You said we have a lot of outcomes.
Yes.
What's the
good a good outcome for Iran is that this current uprisings would result in substantial change without a large number of casualties. I think this current regime has really lost legitimacy and it will not be able to normalize its foreign policy, nor does it enjoy any legitimacy and support domestically. So transition to a new constitution, a new regime with a stability is a good outcome that I hope for.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a talk from economist Nader Habibi. It was recorded in front of an audience at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockland, Maine on January 12th. You can find this episode and many other on-demand programs on our website at mainepublic.org. Click on Shows to find Speaking in Maine and this episode featuring Nader Habibi. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.